To tweet or not to tweet? That is the question facing arts organizations that are trying to engage audiences in a social media-obsessed world. This is Conducting Business, a podcast on the classical music industry from WQXR.org. I'm Naomi Lewin. More and more groups are setting aside tweet seats where audience members are invited to dish out 140-character missives during the performance. A new theater in Seattle is being built to encourage cell phone use, and the Broadway revival of Godspell is incorporating cell phones into the experience. It might surprise you that some of the most aggressive users of social media are orchestras, which are also exploring things like video screens in concert halls and contests involving YouTube. Joining us today to discuss this trend are three guests. Brent Ossink is in the studio. He is executive director of the San Francisco Symphony. And also in the studio, John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds on WNYC. On the phone, I have Christopher Pinello. He is vice president of communications for the Cincinnati Symphony, and he oversees digital initiatives there. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brent, you have probably worked very hard over the past years to get audiences to turn off their phones at concerts. But the San Francisco Symphony is about to introduce tweet seats at a concert series this summer. Now, why are you encouraging people to turn them on now?
So I'm going to respond to your question by actually talking about San Francisco weather, which feels a little bit like a disconnect. Our summer concerts are actually indoors because summers in San Francisco are freezing. So our audiences have become accustomed to having a more informal, relaxed type of experience in our hall in the summers. So it's as if one took the outdoor experience and transplanted it into the concert hall. That's where we're going to experiment with this. And it's going to be in a very specific area of the hall, the second tier seats, totally optional, of course, but the experience will be limited to up there. We're going to see what happens. It's not too dissimilar from the concerts that we used to do in a different venue in the summers where people were eating and drinking during the concerts. So I don't know where this is going to go, but you're absolutely right. We still value the undivided attention that the audience provides to the concert experience. But the summer concerts historically in San Francisco have been
more loosey-goosey.
Relaxed.
All right, Chris Pinello, the Cincinnati Symphony already has a tweet seat section. How's that working for you?
It's been an interesting experiment for us. The idea of tweet seats, I first heard maybe back in 2009 among the United Arts luncheons we have here in Cincinnati, the discussion and very spirited discussion about the prospect of having them. Our approach with tweet seats, and we first introduced them in September, and we don't have them for every concert. It's limited to 20 seats, and it's, I think we're doing it for the fourth time this Friday. The idea is to make them interactive program notes, a different way to engage audience. I admit it's probably not for everyone. It's a different kind of experience, and I sat and did it myself in the fall because I wouldn't be promoting something that I didn't try myself. But we actually have an assistant or associate conductor backstage who is sharing information about the piece they're hearing in real time. And people are able to respond to that and ask questions. And I really look at it as a great way to introduce orchestral music to new audiences.
John Schaefer, as an audience member, I'm sure a frequent audience member, what is your reaction to tweet seats?
Well, my reaction as an audience member is the same as my reaction when I am hosting a live broadcast and find myself now not telling people to shut their phones off, but inviting them to tweet at hashtag whatever. I've found myself on stage saying things like, and you can hashtag you can tweet during this concert at hashtag ecstatic music or hashtag new sounds, or you can just sit and listen. And, to me, that's kind of what I'm hoping people will do. I know it sounds old-fashioned, and I tend not to be an old-fashioned kind of guy, but the idea of tweeting during a concert is not what bothers me. What bothers me is the actual practice of it, the glowing screen, the little tapping. I mean, Brent, where are you guys putting your seats? Do people who sit near the tweet seats know they're sitting near the tweet seats? Because
in fact, we're not calling them tweet seats. We're calling them a hotspot because it, in fact, is the entire second tier, the entire upper balcony of the hall. And again, like I said, it's for our summer concerts. And we, I am really ambivalent about this whole thing. There is, I think, a sense among orchestras and, in fact, among performing arts groups and, in fact, among certain hotels that there is actually a premium to be placed on the fact that you are decoupled from the tyranny of of your wireless device.
Yes, they've just upped that ante on the New Jersey Transit trains, I hear. You know, they're going to be, they are setting aside more and more in an Amtrak, more and more quiet cars. Chris, we should probably direct the question about other audience members to you, because you've already got, you said you've had pushback from some audience members.
We have indeed, and there are some, you know, who have sat near the tweet seats, and frankly, I think some of it's a misunderstanding. You know, I think we have some problems with concert etiquette in general, probably not just in this country, but in the world, where people are sort of pulling out their phones and texting during concerts. And I think there's sort of an association with, oh, this is rude. These people should not be bringing out their phones at all, and they're distracting me. We've really made an effort to take the tweet seats away from other audience as much as we can. No one is sitting behind them at all. And we've moved them actually a few times over the course of the season, sort of trial and error. But the idea is that it's limited to 20 seats, and no one is going to be disturbed by them at this point. But certainly when we first tried it in the balcony level, again, back row, but they were sort of in the within sight of other audience members. And, yeah, we got some pushback from our subscribers.
Now, John, you mentioned standing on stage hosting something and having people tweet or email or whatever while you're, as somebody on stage, how do you feel? Does that make you feel like maybe they're not giving you their full concentration? Or,
well, I'm not sure. I'm all for giving people a chance to express their enthusiasm even in the moment. You know, when you get one of those performances where the hairs on the back of your neck stand up and you feel like elbowing your neighbor and say, did you hear that? Did you feel that? This is another way to do that, and I understand that. But it is also potentially a way that is a little more distracting to people around you. The idea of tweet seats, what happens if this catches on? What happens if half your audience wants to do this? Look, concert going back in the day, you know, in the 19th century, it was a free-for-all.
Yes.
You know, we know that.
Right.
And the sit up straight, you know, eat your vegetable kind of approach to concert going has been a big part of the issue with getting younger listeners especially, but anyone who's not already in the tent, into the tent. So to that extent, I understand the attraction here. I'm not sure this is the right way to do it, simply because of the potential for success and what that does to the concert experience.
Darned if you do and darned if you don't.
Well, I have a question for the two people with orchestras here as to how your musicians feel. Now, I did a little bit of crowdsourcing last night in Cincinnati and also outside of Cincinnati, and I've got to say, I heard from a 30-something member not of the Cincinnati Symphony who thinks that a performance, that this would be very disturbing, tweeting during the performance, that music should be played like a whole picture, and asking how can you pay attention to the music while you are tweeting. Brent, what is your reaction to that? What is the musician's reaction to this?
Our musicians are concerned about it, and I share their concern to a certain degree. And we're going to evaluate this very carefully after the summer to see what effect this has had. And in fact, is it successful? How do we measure success? Are we getting that younger audience in? Are they completely over the moon about it? Is there some sense that because they have permission to do it, therefore they actually do less of it? Yeah, who knows?
Chris, now you said you have an assistant conductor who's backstage aiding and abetting this,
yeah,
so to speak. But what do members of the orchestra have to say about this?
I haven't gotten any negative feedback from the orchestra members. And ultimately, this is about building audience. And I think most musicians recognize that that we're looking to expand our audience base. And I also really think this is an entry point for a lot of people. And I think ultimately, too, you've tried tweet seats a couple of times, and I would hope they'd want to put down their phone eventually. But I think it's a nice introduction to music. And it's not like they're sitting there playing Angry Birds.
Well, how do you know that they're not sitting there playing Angry
Birds?
Well, they
shouldn't be there sitting.
One of the op-ed pieces that was written in the New York Times said, how do we know that they're not just sitting there playing Angry Birds rather than listening to the concert?
Why would they come to a concert hall to play Angry Birds when they can sit and play Angry Birds at home?
Well, I have to tell you that Years ago, I saw people sitting in the balcony of the Cincinnati Symphony, an entire family sitting there reading their books during the concert. And I wanted to say to them, why didn't you stay home and read your books with a CD on? But that was their concert experience. The books, of course, were not disrupting anybody else's experience. But
sure, sure. I think we're really looking at this as a different level of engagement for... There are people who will sit at home watching an award show, like the Academy Awards. They'll watch the Super Bowl, and they actually are on Twitter or on Facebook, and they're interacting with people, their huge circle of friends, talking about it as it's happening. And it's just a different kind of interaction. It's a different kind of shared experience. I think some people have a thirst for that kind of shared experience. The idea is they're completely engaged in the music. That most of the tweets, if you look at the list of tweets from a CSO tweet seed experience, most of them are actually coming from backstage. Most of them are coming from either the assistant or associate conductor, whoever's on duty for that particular concert. And it's very interesting. It's very engaging. They're actually talking about the music. So. Yes, I think that multitasking doesn't necessarily work, and again, Angry Birds at a CSO concert is not something I would advocate, but this is different.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention award shows, because during the last iteration of the Grammy Awards, my show, Soundcheck, decided to do some live tweeting. Now, again, this is not a concert. We're all watching TV. My experience with that was, A, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of back and forth with listeners, which was great. Got the audience involved in a kind of a different way. What I noticed a couple of times was, because I was either tweeting or laughing at something that a listener had tweeted or something, that there were a couple of moments during the broadcast where I had to turn to my wife and say, what did he say? What just happened? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very similar to a comic whose patter is really rapid, and the jokes are flying fast and furious, and you're laughing at joke number one, and you've missed joke number two because there is that danger. And again, it's the danger of this idea succeeding. Mm-hmm. If it succeeds, if you are genuinely involved both in the live experience in the hall and this simultaneous experience on Twitter, inevitably something is going to get missed.
Brent, I have to say, you probably did a lot of research before you decided to start what you're calling your hotspot. How much do you think orchestras are trying to do things like this as part of really a concentrated strategy to build audiences? And how much do you think it's maybe kind of jumping on a bandwagon, a trendy kind of thing, until the next trendy thing comes along?
We actually didn't do a lot of research. This is, like I said, the summers, more relaxed. We just decided to add this as a possible option for people to consider, you know, and just to see where it would go and see what would happen with it. It worries me when orchestras do go chasing after the latest, greatest thing, because it fundamentally begs the question about whether Beethoven's enough. Do we need to add layers of various types of experiences around our concerts? We have a history of doing that. And certainly, as we heard earlier, there is a history of concert-going etiquette that has changed so dramatically over the years. And we have become much more formal and much more ritualized in our whole concert experience over the last, say, you know, several decades. So,
and how do you pull back? I guess the question then is how you pull back from the formality. I know that in Cincinnati...
You bring a book and you read a book when you get bored.
Well, in Cincinnati, I don't know about in San Francisco, there are video screens explaining points of the concert that you're going to see before the concert starts. And some concert halls, I know the Cincinnati Pops has dramatic lighting in concert halls. They don't do that yet for the symphony concerts. Do these help make the experience more accessible to a wider audience? Chris, why don't you speak to that?
I think it does. I think it's sort of the whole demystification of what we do on stage. And, you know, I work very hard on those prelude videos at Cincinnati, which we share online before the concerts, but are actually shown then before the music starts. And I think it sort of breaks down that barrier between performer and audience. It also gives the audience a chance to see the human side of our musicians. They're actually sharing stories and anecdotes, and sometimes it gets a good laugh, but I think it's very informative, and it's a way to sort of set the tone for the concert.
Brent, Michael Tilson Thomas has led the YouTube Symphony
right.
auditioning
right.
for orchestra members through right. video submissions. The Pittsburgh Symphony is now holding an online video contest to find a soloist. Is YouTube the wave of the future?
I think to a certain degree it is. I think that to put an optimistic spin on all of this, we can reach audiences now in ways that we never, ever dreamed of. We do not need... it is now possible to go directly from the orchestra and what the orchestra is producing right on out to anybody who self-selects, who identifies himself as interested in this material. I think it's tremendously exciting.
And let's not forget Eric Whitaker and his virtual mm-hmm. choir.
Exactly.
Which is now in its third or fourth, I mean, it's like V3.0 now, and has been hugely successful, not yeah. just, you know, in boosting his profile, but also, you know...
Very much in boosting.
the idea of choral music as just another form of communal music making and extending that community to even people who are not part of the chorus but are part of the, 60 million people who have gone to that YouTube page and checked it out.
It gives people a sense that they are actually can be music makers themselves. It's
yeah.
really fundamental. You know, for decades, orchestras have known that the single greatest predictor of whether people are going to attend their concerts or not is whether they played a musical instrument or sang in a choir at some point in their life, 70% over the decades and over all different types of orchestras. To the extent that YouTube or technology like YouTube encourages that kind of behavior, it's, I think, ultimately going to be a good thing for orchestras.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think it makes everything so much more accessible. You know, Long is one of our creative directors this season in Cincinnati, and we're having a master class with him in May. The entries are all through YouTube. So mm-hmm. essentially, every kid 8 to 16 is submitting up to 10-minute video onto YouTube. We have a local panel selecting 10 of those, and he'll select 3 for the master class. But it opens it up to the world, and anyone can record themselves playing the piano and submit that to YouTube. It's an easy process.
And the interesting thing here, I mean, to bring this back to our first topic of conversation, the Twitterverse, and concertizing, you know, within that realm is the difference here. YouTube is also interactive, potentially, but it's displaced in time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening mm-hmm. at the same time that Eric Whitaker is assembling his choir or Michael Tilson Thomas is conducting the orchestra. It's in the same place at the same time, but displaced in time. And that is, I think, a key difference between YouTube and a host of other technologies that are out there, including social media and live tweeting.
Now, since we all sort of agree that this has to do with making the music more accessible, are there other things potentially on the horizon that could be done to make concerts more accessible? For example, what musicians wear, that they come out in formal attire. Do you think that would help make concerts more accessible to the audience, Brent?
I think one of the lessons that we can take, interesting object lessons, is what is happening at New World Symphony in their new venue, where they essentially...
Also Michael Tilson Thomas.
Exactly, where mm-hmm. essentially they've turned the experience inside out, where, you know, so many of our concert halls are kind of mysterious buildings to a certain degree. They're not necessarily user-friendly.
For Temples of music.
Yeah, exactly. For the casual passerby, they may not even know what's going on in that building. And so what's happening in New World, among many other things, is that the mystery has been resolved to a certain extent by the wall cast, but also people need to be able to walk by and see that things are going on in the building that really attract them in, that almost magnetize them in. And our buildings are completely the opposite right now. They're, generally speaking, they have their backs to the street, and you can come in, but you have to figure out almost a secret code about how to figure out how to do that. So I think that's one. It's interesting. This whole question about making the concert experience more accessible is as complicated a question to answer as there are a number of people in our halls. Many of our young audience members actually get offended by how casually dressed the older people are and how it is not as special as an experience as they would like it to be. This is a big night out for some young people. So they actually like the formality of it. They like the ritual and so forth. So it's a infinitely interesting question to explore.
Chris, what is your experience with that?
You know, we've actually experiment a little bit with concert attire in Cincinnati, and we have different attire on different evenings and try to Saturday night sort of the big splashy bring a date night. There's a strolling violinist in the lobby, and the orchestra is in tails. But I think definitely how the attire and the entire approach to a concert can affect people's experiences, for sure. And at the same time, you know, we could have, and talking about using technology, we could have a sold-out concert like we had with Itzhak Perlman at the beginning of the season, or Yo-Yo Ma last season, where we're opening it up to the public, and we could, our version of Times Square here in Cincinnati is Fountain Square, and we can beam that concert live via simulcast to a huge video board, and people come in shorts and bottles of beer and have a different kind of experience, but they're all experiencing the music.
With their smartphones, so they can tweet
exactly.
from it.
No one's going to give them a hard time on Fountain Square about tweeting.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I would look. I mean, the New World, Brent, is a good kind of example to hold up. Another one right here in New York is the renewed and stripped down Brooklyn Philharmonic, mm-hmm. which perforce has kind of taken on the topic of how do we look like our audience? You know, how do we make ourselves relevant in our community? And I've heard over the years, you know, within African American and Latino communities, constantly musicians, composers, administrators, people like Aaron Dworkin of the Sphinx organization in Detroit saying, you know, the problem is you want to get the kids while they're young, mm-hmm. but the kids want to see people up there who look like them. And obviously we can't just like go in and just change the personnel of all the orchestras. But people who are used to wearing shorts and sneakers and jeans and t-shirts, etc., feel more comfortable thinking that this is perfectly acceptable attire. And, you know, so the Brooklyn Philharmonic, when they'd go to Bushwick or Bed-Stuy, last year they brought the rapper Mos Def with them, mm-hmm. who, by the way, did a really credible version of the Frederick Jevsky classic piece coming together with the orchestra. And this was an orchestra's public relations dream, this audience that was not in a hall. They were the band was on a stage on a street corner, and the audience filled both the street and the avenue coming to this corner. And everybody was having a great time. They were dressed the way they were dressed, which included the musicians of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the New York Times came and took photos and did a big splashy article. It was a wonderful experience. And they have kind of taken that, you know. I have not seen the current edition of the Brooklyn Phil in ties and tails. Mm-hmm. You know, they tend to be a lot more informal. They're drawing an audience of younger, informal concertgoers for whom the Brooklyn Phil, this is the hope at least, might just be tonight's concert, and then tomorrow night we're back at the Indie Rock Club down the hall, you know, down the block. Mm-hmm. This is really what they're going for, and I think is
so
a...
Not going to happen soon at the New York Philharmonic?
Well, this gets to another point.
Cincinnati Symphony?
Well, it gets to another point, which is we have to be responsive to our communities and be paying attention to our communities, and I think the Brooklyn example is a very telling one. They have found a way to really interact, engage, reflect their community in a way that is obviously totally different from what the New York Phil is doing. We're here.
It's also, you probably have multiple communities.
Well,
certainly
exactly.
The Brooklyn Phil does. So mm-hmm. when they go to Brighton Beach, where there's to Little Odessa, they're not bringing Mos Def. They're bringing silent Russian films and doing live music to that. So
it's wonderful. Creativity at its best. We're here in New York playing the Mavericks Festival concerts at Carnegie Hall.
The San Francisco Symphony.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing about this is that the orchestra is dressed in all black. They're not in white tie and tails. It was jarring, actually, to see them in white tie and tails playing this music. It just felt like a great disconnect. So when we started talking about this, it was pretty, you know, not a big debate, actually. This is a disconnect mm-hmm. between attire and what is actually coming from the orchestra.
When you think about how technology has evolved other media, let's pick a rock concert, for instance. If you saw the Beatles at Shea Stadium in 1965 and then saw Paul McCartney last summer, you're seeing a completely different kind of experience, a much more engaging experience now because of screens and because of lighting effects and things like that. I think audiences are coming to expect that more and more.
And the world of opera is well ahead. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things I have seen in recent years was the Tristan Project, mm-hmm. which was Esa-Pekka Salonen conducting Wagner's Tristan und Isolde with a simultaneous video kind of meditation by Bill Viola. And the combination of the two, you know, this was a 21st century extension of the operatic tradition, but we're seeing a lot of that in the opera house.
It's interesting you bring that up, because when I saw it, I felt like it was just a totally different experience than any other Tristan. Like
it was
you were kind of doing Wagner slash Viola,
right,
and that if I wanted to hear the opera, or even in a concert version hear the opera, that is not what I would do,
mm-hmm.
because I was so transfixed by the video and everything like that. I didn't even really pay that much attention to either the orchestra or the soloists on the stage.
And I found myself having to remember to draw breath at various mm-hmm. points. Like, you know, at the last thing I would have wanted to do was, oh, I got to tweet this to my friends.
Yet another third level of interaction, right?
Bringing it back to the subject of tweeting, there are some musicians in the orchestra who have a lot of time on their hands between entrances. They've been known maybe in opera pits or elsewhere to read magazines on their stands while they're waiting. So how soon will it be until, for example, trombonists, while they're counting all their measures of rest, start tweeting from the back of the orchestra during the concert?
Nailed it!
That's right. Hope you like that one. I hope I'm not in this business long enough to see that happen.
Chris, anybody in the Cincinnati Symphony yet tweeting from on stage?
We actually, during Paavo Järvi's finale concert last May, an orchestra member took a spectacular photo with his iPhone of Paavo from the orchestra standpoint and posted it. And it was during bowels. It wasn't during the actual performance, but I thought it was a pretty spectacular photo. And he posted it and everyone loved it.
Well, thank you all for joining us. This has been Conducting Business, WQXR.org's podcast on the classical music industry. Our guests have been Brett Alsink of the San Francisco Symphony, John Schaefer of WNYC's program Soundcheck, and Christopher Pinello from the Cincinnati Symphony. Brian Wise is our producer, and Jason Isaac was our engineer. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thanks for listening.